Good evening, everyone, and welcome to eBible Fellowship's question and answer time tonight. Excuse me. This evening, we're going to take a look at the Bible with any questions or comments that anyone may have, and each person is invited to share what's ever on your mind by raising your hand and taking the microphone. And I'll try to respond as much as I'm able by going to the Bible, as the Bible is God's Word, and it is the authority in all matters, spiritual matters, and it also is, of course, the one place we want to turn to when we're looking at things concerning the future or things to come, because no man knows anything about the future. I know I don't, and when you hear the charge of date setting, it makes it sound as if when a date is put forth for the return of Christ, that it's coming from man. And actually, you know, to be to be honest, that is true. Or has been true, probably in many cases, if people have predicted dates for the coming of Christ, because those dates weren't based on the Bible at all. But, however, when individuals have gone to the Bible and they have followed the Bible's methods to search it out and have tried as much as they're able, although they're finite and fallible, and God tells us that His thoughts are higher than our thoughts, and so we have to recognize that we need God's help greatly in coming to truth. But when we do go to the Bible and we find information there, and we see how things fit together, like we did with May 21. The question really has to be looked at who set that date? Was that man's date? Was it men that laid out the biblical calendar of history? Oh yeah, Mr. Camping was able to discover it within the Bible, but He didn't create the biblical calendar. God did it. It's on the pages of the Bible, the genealogies in the early chapters of Genesis prove to be a historical biblical calendar, and we could trace the timeline of the Bible all the way down through history. And since the Bible begins with creation, we could know the creation date, and we were able to follow that timeline down all through biblical history, through the patriarchs, to the flood, beyond the flood to Abraham, and then Isaac and Jacob, and the captivity period in Egypt, and the conquest of the land of Canaan, and the period of the judges, and then the kings, until the carrying away into Babylon, and even after, we were able to carry it all the way down, and we saw that we could date the birth of Christ in 7 B.C., the crucifixion of Christ in 33 A.D., and all these things fit in a very purposeful pattern, in a harmonious way. We saw time relationships between all of these, many of these key historical dates. And then when these dates were projected into the future, well, we saw that from the flood in 4990 B.C., until 2011, was 7,000 years exactly. And long before that, there was information that the church age would be 1,955 years and come to its end in 1988. And then there would be a great tribulation of 23 years. And it so happened that 23-year period began May 21, 1988 and ended May 21, 2011. And then someone accidentally did, this wasn't thought out by man. This was the hand of God. Someone noticed that May 21, the last day of a 23-year exact Great Tribulation, the 8400th day, also happened to be the 17th day of the second Hebrew month. And that was the day after 7 days that God shut the door of the ark and brought the flood. And God is the one who put all that together. Who set that date? It wasn't Mr. Camping. It wasn't Family Radio. It wasn't any man. It was information that came from the Bible. And likewise, as long as we find our information in the Bible and we find evidence in the Bible to that locks in a date like May 21, well, then it can't be said that man is setting those dates. And then as we continue to study, we find in the book of Esther that there is a timeline, and it's a very interesting timeline all by itself, because at the end of it, it is a day when the Jews avenge themselves of their enemies, and they live, and then they enter into a rest period, and it's just a great victory for the people of God. It was intended for evil, and it was turned to good. And we can see how the end of the world would fit into that kind of scenario. The end of the world is a time when all the enemies of the kingdom of God and the people of God are utterly destroyed. And we see in the book of Esther that God makes a special point. He really focuses in on a particular event in the midst of that timeline. After the date is selected and after all the 127 provinces have been warned about that date, there is a historical situation that develops between Mordecai and Esther and Haman and King Ahasuerus. And everything comes to a head as Esther goes in to beseech the king for herself, for her own life, and for the lives of her people. And we stand amazed that how amazing a story it is. It's true history, but still it's exciting and dramatic and all sorts of twists and turns and things happen unexpectedly. And this particular point of Esther going into the king and that particular day is the 17th day of the second month in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. And when we see that date, God has conditioned us to realize, oh, that's the date that the flood began. That's the date that right away we associate with May 21. It is the equivalent date, basically, of May 21. It's as though God is putting his finger on that day in the book of Esther, and he's saying, look, here is a historical parable that is going to teach you about May 21 and what actually happened, what took place upon that day. And when we study the book of Esther, we find that it was an incredible day that is given at least three chapters, more than that in leading up to it, in chapter 4 and chapter 5, builds the drama leading up to that day, and then three chapters after that, 6, 7, and 8, focus on the day itself. It really is astonishing that one particular day is given almost five chapters, two in anticipation and then three that build upon it. And it's a day of intense events from the point that the king cannot sleep and hearing about the doorkeepers, the rebel doorkeepers, and asking the question, what honor and dignity has been done to Mordecai for this? And then Haman, who happens to be in the outer court at that very moment, and he's there in order to request that Mordecai might be hanged. And before he can speak the words, the king asks, what shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman, in his pride, thinks it's himself, and he says, well, let the man be clothed with the king's robes and wear the king's crown and ride the king's horse, and let the most noble prince declare before him, thus shall be done unto the man whom the king delights to honor. And that's teaching us this is, of course, spiritually Satan's desire to be the king. He wants to be like God. And yet God turns it around from that point, and he says, take the clothing and the crown and the horse and go do to Mordecai and let not a word fail. And there we see the nature of May 21. It very early in the day, it is the humiliation, the deposing, the putting down of Satan from his lofty perch, from the grand seat. Remember, he had taken his seat as the man of sin in the temple. And yet now, May 21 was the exact 23rd year. It was the completion of the judgment on the church. It was time for him to come to no longer be the one seated ruling in the church. He had accomplished the task God had given him in bringing that judgment, as God used him to bring desolation, spiritual desolation to the congregations. And so he was put down, just as Haman is humiliated. And at the same time, Mordecai is exalted, and he's clothed with the king's clothing and crown and rides the king's horse. And Haman is the one who is who is saying, thus shall it be done unto the man unto whom the king delights to honor. That is, Satan is forced to give glory and honor to the Lord Jesus Christ on the 17th day of the second month, that is May 21. And the book of Esther doesn't stop there. As Haman goes rushing to his house, mourning with his head covered because he's shamefaced, he's just completely humiliated with what's taken place. You can imagine how far his heart dropped. And everything had been going his way. Seemingly the king was supporting his every move. And now his greatest enemy, the arch enemy, Mordecai, the one who he had requested of the king to have him and all the Jews killed, although he didn't mention the Jews or Mordecai, but that was the purpose. And now Mordecai was exalted. So Haman rushes to his home, and while he's talking to his wife and his friends, and while they're speaking to him about his fall, and it's emphasized, I think that word is used two or three times, Haman's fall, because it's the date of Satan's fall. While they're speaking with him, the king's chamberlains come and rush him off to Esther's second, to the second banquet that Esther has prepared. Now that reminds us of the book of Job, when Job is experiencing the severe trial of losing everything, and that really points to and typifies the judgment of God that was on the Lord Jesus, as Job is a picture of Christ, who emptied himself of his glory to experience the wrath of God. And remember, as one messenger was describing the loss of Job's livestock and property, the next would come. And while he was yet speaking, another would come, until finally they told him of his children had died. And that's how it is in Esther. While they were speaking to Haman, they rushed him to the banquet because it's judgment day. It is the day that Satan is judged, from one judgment, humiliation, and where he's forced to give Christ the glory, he's rushed off to another judgment. And Haman goes into the banquet of wine, and it's not long before the king asks her, "What is thy request?" "And it shall be granted thee unto the half of the kingdom." And then Esther reveals her request finally, and that's all taken place on the 17th day of the second month, May 21, spiritually. And what is the request? Her life and the life of her people, because this wicked Haman, he's the adversary and the enemy. He's the one who has sold, because of him, all the Jews are subject to die, including Queen Esther. And the king, in his fury, in his wrath, goes and leaves them in order to bring in the guards, who will eventually cover Haman's head and take him away to hang him upon the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. And we can see there that emphasis is on the wrath of the king. And it's not until Haman is hanged that it says the king's wrath was appeased, because it's the wrath of God. It's the banquet of the wine of the wrath of God. And God is spelling it out. This is what took place. This was the judgment that was on May 21. And now, of course, when Satan's a spirit being. We never saw him seated in the church. You can't see his spirit. He's a fallen angel, and you can't see him. And therefore, you can't see the judgment upon him. And Christ is God, and God is spirit. He's not in the world in bodily form. And so we couldn't see that Christ was exalted on May 21. We couldn't see that at all. And all the Jews, not 90% of them, not 99% of them, but all the Jews in all 127 provinces were delivered by the intercession of Esther on the 17th day of the second month. They were all spared when the king granted Esther's request, and it was that same day also that he also granted her and Mordecai to write the second letter of Purim that would reverse Haman's wicked devices. And therefore, all the Jews were delivered on the 17th day of the second month, which spiritually the Jews represent the elect. And that teaches us that all of God's elect people were delivered from destruction on the last day on May 21 or prior to May 21. It was only a matter then in the book of Esther of the actual passing of time before the date comes. And what do we find? We find not one single Jew dies on the 13th of Adar during Purim. And it all goes back to the intercession of Esther. And we talked about her intercession previously, but this teaches us that God saved all of his elect people before he shut the door on May 21 of 2011. So we can see all of these elements. We also see that Haman, who typifies Satan, was put down, but he had 10 sons. And his 10 sons significantly did not die with him on the 17th day of the second month. They continued to live until the Feast of Purim, Adar 13. And then they were, it speaks of them actually as though they were killed twice, because it indicates the second death. The 10 sons of Haman point to the 10 horns that we read about in the book of Revelation. And it's telling us that even though Satan was put down, he still exists. And the 10 horns and the beast and all that is all referring to the same spirit being, the devil. And he wasn't destroyed utterly where he ceased to exist. He still exists, but he will be completely destroyed on the last day. And we have to say, because all this is coming from the Bible, who set the date of Purim? Who is involved in date setting here? God's the one who locked in May 21. And God's the one who's so completely identifying the events in the book of Esther with May 21 and the 17th day of the second month. Therefore, God is the one who is putting his finger on the Feast of Purim. Well, thank you. At this time, we're going to open up the room, and everyone is welcome to share what's ever on your mind by raising your hand and on Pal Talk. I've been doing Pal Talk question and answer, or had been doing it for many years, and I can't get out of the habit. That's what I would always say. It would be simple. I would be in the room. People would raise their hand. Skype's it's relatively new, and I'm not used to the different ways that people can join us. But let me read this little introduction for people. If you would like to ask a question, if you're dialing on the phone, or if you're listening on Pal Talk and you would like to call, you can dial 1-209-647-1600 and enter the access code 181610 followed by the pound key. To get in line to ask a question, press *6 and then 1. Now, if you're on Skype, the address is freeconferencecallhd.1600 Skype user. And then you click the dial pad button, and you also enter the access code 181610 followed by the pound key, and you would do the same thing after that point. To get in line to ask a question, press *6 and then 1. And if you're on Pal Talk, please raise your hand, and when asked to, post your question, and your question will be relayed by one of the admins there. Okay, now at this point, we'll go to our first caller tonight. Welcome to eBibles Question and Answer.
Hi, Chris. I want to ask you, I was interested about, I get this echo again.
Excuse me?
I hear an echo myself. You were talking about watching, and I was looking at the word watch. It shows up twice in the Old Testament as morning watch.
I'm sorry, I'm not catching. You're talking about the word watch?
Yeah.
Four,
okay. You were talking about the four watches?
Right, okay.
In 1 Samuel 11, there's one of the places where it talks about the morning watch, and there's a figure of Satan there called Nahash, which actually means serpent. And then in verse 11, if you could read that. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with, you know, our day,
even though
it's a morning watch.
It says, and it was so on the morrow that Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the host in the morning watch and slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And it came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together. Well, that last part does remind us of not one stone upon another. So the Ammonites, like the Moabites, are used at times in the Bible to typify the corporate churches.
Right.
Had relationship to the people of God and through Lot. But other than that, I really don't know what this verse is teaching.
And the other one is in Exodus 14:24, where God brings the Red Sea back over the Egyptians.
Yeah. Yeah, it says, and it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel, and it was a cloud and darkness to them, but it gave light by night to thee, so that the one came not near the other all the night. Where does it say the watch, the morning? Oh, verse 24?
Yeah.
The Egyptians pursued, and then verse 24, and it came to pass that in the morning watch Jehovah looked unto the host of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and of the cloud, and troubled the host of the Egyptians. And did you have a comment about that?
Well, just that there's, in both cases, there's a figure of Satan being destroyed, and it's referring to the morning watch, which we were talking about couple of days ago, the four watches. And I was just wondering if it had any application to,
When we look at the watches, it says in Mark 13:35, watch ye therefore, for ye know not when the master of the house cometh. At even, or at midnight, or at the cock crowing, or in the morning. So there it are the four watches, the night watches. We know there's 12 hours in the day in which men would work, and that would be 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And then there would be four watches of the night, 3 hours each. And I think since midnight is mentioned here, that these references are referring to the last hour of each of the four watches. For instance, even would be 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., but I think the emphasis would be on 9, And then 3 hours later, the last hour of the second watch would be midnight. And then the last hour of the third watch, the cock crowing, would be 3 a.m. And then the last hour of the morning would be 6. Now, that would end that watch and begin the 6-hour or the 12-hour day in which men would work.
Okay. So it's likely that it doesn't, those morning watches don't have any reference point to tie in with Purim.
Well,
the ninth hour.
Well, the interesting thing that was suggested was that the three watches, there's I think it's in Luke 12. Let's read that over in Luke 12. It says in verse 38, and if he shall come in the second watch or come in the third watch and find them so, blessed are those servants. And so it was suggested there that the fourth watch isn't mentioned. And so the idea was presented that the first watch would be May 21, the second watch October 21, and the third watch the Feast of Purim. And you know, we are watchmen, and it is interesting that May 21 can be identified as the first watch, like we were discussing the other night. We can say that would be the first watch based on that 12-hour day and the day, the 11th, the 12th hour ending at the end of the Great Tribulation, and then the first evening watch could be identified with May 21. So that had some merit. And also to watch, we were watchmen blowing the trumpet. And also we were watching very closely October 21. And again, now we're watching Purim. And we're sharing this information with people. So it has that idea. And the interesting thing was also suggested that if you follow the night watches, the first would be 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., the second, 9 p.m. to midnight, and the third, midnight to 3 a.m. And therefore, the third watch would be the 7th, 8th, and 9th hour since the night watches began at 6 p.m. Midnight to 3 shift is the 7th, 8th, and 9th hour since 6 p.m. And that happens to be the date in March of Purim, March 7th, 8th, and 9th. So that was the interesting idea regarding it, and we just have to leave it at that. I think right now we can identify May 21, I think, legitimately as the first watch, but we would need to find other information in the Bible to associate October 21 and at least with the second watch, and I don't think we've been able to find it, so it's just an interesting idea right now.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you for those verses. Let's go to the next person. Welcome to eBibles Question and Answer.
Our first question from Pal Talk tonight comes from Sherv One. She asks if you could elaborate on Daniel chapter 6, verses 7 and 8. The question is it teaching that believers at this time, is it teaching that they are in the den of lions?
Well, no, not at that point. In Daniel 6, presidents, the other two presidents, there was three of them, and Daniel was the first. And the princes, of which I think there were 120, and those princes would be princes over each of the provinces. So at this time, at this point in history, when the Medes and the Persians took the kingdom of Babylon, the king, Darius, excuse me, ruled over 120 provinces and not the 127 that a later descendant, Ahasuerus, would rule over. So the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians would expand over the next century or two, and next century or so, and they would get even larger and gain seven more provinces. But at this time, it's 120. It's still a great kingdom. And Darius is very favorable to Daniel. He let's just look at the language of Daniel 6 verse 2, and over these three presidents, of whom Daniel was first, that the princes might give accounts unto him, and the king should have no damage, then this Daniel was preferred above the presidents and princes, because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king thought to set him over the whole realm. So we actually find that the spiritual context for Daniel 6 is the end of the Great Tribulation, because in the previous chapter, the last verse, the last two verses, we read that the king of Babylon was killed by the Medes and the Persians, and the Medes and Persians took the kingdom, and that's the end of the 70 years. Now, the king of Babylon typifies Satan as he ruled during the Great Tribulation over the churches and over the world that had been given him. But now, in other words, it's May 21 again. Sorry I keep mentioning it, but the Bible keeps focusing on it. And it's the end of the rule of Satan. It's also not a coincidence. It's very significant that the king of Babylon had been drinking wine at a banquet. He was in a banquet house, and it was due to his pride that the judgment of God came upon him. And that is very similar to Haman. Haman was invited to a banquet of wine. And it was at the banquet of wine that Haman met his death. And his pride led him right there. And it was at the banquet house where he was drinking wine that the king of Babylon met his death at the very end of 70 years. So the date of the 17th day in the second month in the book of Esther identifies with May 21, and the date of 539 BC in the book of Daniel, and the end of Babylon, when the king of Babylon met his death, also identify with May 21. We really have a spiritual synonym, a historical parable that is synonymous with the account in Esther. And so we would think, okay, and also, in addition to that, we have Darius, also known as Cyrus, that takes the kingdom of Babylon. And Isaiah, the last verse of Isaiah 44, and the first verse of Isaiah chapter 45, uses language to describe Cyrus as God's shepherd and his anointed one. And the word anointed there is the same word Messiah that's found in Daniel 9. And that's because Cyrus is a type of Christ. When he takes the kingdom of Babylon, we have another parallel to the exaltation of Mordecai. Haman is killed, Mordecai is exalted. The king of Babylon is slain at a banquet of wine, and Cyrus takes the kingdom. Now he rules over all that the king of Babylon ruled over. And that's the language we read where it says of Cyrus that he ruled over all the nations of the earth. God is really making a special point of letting us know that the one who is ruling right now and has been ruling over all authority and all powers in this world, as well as he's always ruled over everything, but you see, certain authority had been given to Satan, but that authority is now removed, and the one ruling is the Lord Jesus Christ. And right away, you and I can understand completely why you might feel this way, because I felt this way. How could that be possible when it has been nothing but just great difficulty? There's been tremendous affliction, tremendous persecution or reviling, just tremendous pressure that has been put upon the children of God, the same ones that were listening to the Bible and desirous to do the will of God and wanted to be obedient to him and faithful, just like Daniel and just like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And what did Daniel get for his faithfulness when Cyrus took the kingdom? Cyrus was favorable to him, just like Jesus, of course, is favorable to his people now at this time. But what happened with Daniel? Was everything just peaches and cream? Was everything comfortable and wonderful after Darius took the kingdom? Darius lifted him up, didn't he? And set him above all those other princes and presidents. Well, no. Actually, Daniel now had to face his most difficult challenge that he had ever faced. And he had already gone through some trying times under King Nebuchadnezzar and some of the king's sons. He had endured a long time in Babylon. You can be sure that Daniel was very weary of all the previous trials. And now at the end of the 70 years, it's not that he's just quickly exalted by this king who's favorable to him, but he must now face the most trying time of his life as those presidents and princes plot against him and they deceive the king into passing a law. And the law states here in verse 7 of Daniel 6, all the presidents of the kingdom, the governors and the princes, the counselors and the captains have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whosoever shall ask a petition of any god or man for 30 days, save of thee, O king, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not. Wherefore, King Darius signed the writing and the decree. Now, Darius was he was a man, and he was probably an unsaved man, therefore subject to pride and as men can easily be deceived. And here were all of his most trusted servants, all the princes, and they said all the presidents. They weren't Daniel wasn't there, but they didn't point out at all that he didn't agree with it. So they lied to him, and the whole thing was a trap for Daniel, and they played on the king's pride that this was something to really lift him up, and it was all positive. It was patriotic. They were being just good citizens of the kingdom. And yet behind it, it was nothing but a deceitful trap to catch Daniel, and they did, because Daniel continued to pray to God as he had previously, and this teaches us the principle that when a government passes a law that's contrary to the law of God, we continue to obey the law of God, and we suffer whatever consequences are necessary. We cannot bow down to the law of man over the law of God. Well, as a result of Daniel breaking this law, the king has no choice. And even though he labors, he's so favorable to Daniel that he labors to the going down of the sun to deliver him. It says in verse 14, and the king, when he heard these words, was sore displeased with himself. He realized he was fooled, and set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. And he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. Then these men assembled unto the king, and said unto the king, know, O king, that the law of the Medes and Persians is that no decree nor statute which the king establisheth may be changed. Then the king commanded, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. And again, the spiritual context of this account. And this is basically the end of the historical narrative in the book of Daniel. The historical narrative has gone from the first chapter and all the way through chapter 6. But then in chapter 7, we'll find that it's basically about Daniel's vision. And even though there's time references to the reign of a king here and there, basically the rest of the book of Daniel has to do with the visions of God. And the historical narrative comes to an end because chapter 5 identifies with the end of the Great Tribulation, May 21, and chapter 6 is the postscript. It is the last chapter dealing with God's people, and that is pointing to our time right now. Now, the New Testament has a commentary on this in 2 Timothy chapter 4. And here, remember the Apostle Paul is used of God as a pattern of the believer. We read that earlier in Timothy. And in this case, in 2 Timothy 4, it says in verse 6, for I am now ready to be offered, and the time of my departure is at hand. I have fought a good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith. So this is referring to the end of the ministry of Paul, and Paul is a pattern of the believers. And we can see how this relates to God's people and the end of our time of ministry. And it's really keeping in line with that, that it says in verse 16 of 2 Timothy 4, at my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. I pray God that it may not be laid to their charge, notwithstanding the Lord stood with me and strengthened me. Now, latter rain, the 17-year period, almost, from September 94 until May 21 of 2011, was the period when the two witnesses stood on their feet. And it was then that God stood with his people as the gospel was brought to the world, and God saved the great multitude. And then it goes on to say, the Lord stood with me and strengthened me, that by me the preaching might be fully known, and that all the Gentiles might hear. And the word Gentiles is nations. Now we have to actually look to the spiritual meaning to properly understand this, because it's just not so that the preaching was fully known because of Paul historically, and all the nations did not hear from Paul. He was a well-traveled missionary. He went to many places, but he didn't go to all the nations, and the word of God was sealed up till the time of the end, Daniel tells us. So how could the preaching be fully known? And it's only when we understand Paul is a type of the believers at the end, when our time of departure is at hand, when we finish our course, that we realize it's referring to when the two witnesses stood on their feet during the latter rain, and it was then that God opened up the scriptures. He took the seals off the Bible, and it's then that the preaching was fully known, and it was then, leading up to May 21, that all the nations heard. As Matthew 24 says, this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations. It's the same word that's translated Gentiles here. And so we can relate all these things to what happened just prior to May 21. And then now we understand the last part of 2 Timothy 4:17. And it goes on to say, I was delivered out of the mouth of the lion. Because that's the very next thing that follows spiritually. And you know, I'm sure we can relate to Daniel somewhat, because there's a spiritual weariness, really a spiritual weariness that God's people have been experiencing. We just went through a great tribulation. Just as Daniel went through reigns of evil kings of Babylon, well, we've just lived through a period when Satan was reigning in the churches, when the world is gone after sin like never before, and sin is multiplied across the face of the earth. And God arranged it. He opened the scriptures. He moved in his people to make one last urgent plea, to warn the world as watchmen, to sound the trumpet. And God's people did it with much of their resources and with all of their heart. And they shared the gospel to all the world. And then, well, the Great Tribulation ended. May 21 came. And just as the king of Babylon fell, well, so too did Satan. Of course, spiritually, we couldn't see that. And just as Cyrus took the kingdom, so Christ took over the authority of Satan in this world. But again, spiritually, we couldn't see that. And just as Daniel then had to undergo the greatest trial of his life, and that any greater than anything he had previously been through, he was now cast into a den of lions, and it seemed that all was against him, even though the king was favorable to him. Yet it was necessary. There was no way around it. The king had to cast Daniel into the lion's den. And it's necessary for God's people this time to go through the fiery trial of faith. It is the day of the, as 1 Corinthians 3 tells us, the day will make manifest of what sort our faith is. And what happened with Daniel? Well, he was a true child of God, and God protected him, and finally no harm came to him. He wasn't hurt at all by the lions. And that will be the end result, too, for God's people. Just as it says of Paul, and I was delivered out of the mouth of a lion. And it's not a pleasant experience to be cast into a lion's den and to spend the night with hungry lions. Yet it definitely demonstrated the great care and protection God has for his people. And it glorified him in a tremendous way. Let's read, and we'll close after this. Going back to Daniel 6, after the night passes, and we read in verse 18, and the king went to his palace and passed the night fasting. Neither were instruments of music brought before him, and his sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning, and went in haste unto the den of lions. And when he came to the den, he cried with a lamentable voice unto Daniel. And the king spake and said to Daniel, O Daniel, servant of the living God, is thy God, whom thou servest continually, able to deliver thee from the lions? Then said Daniel unto the king, O king, live forever. My God has sent his angel, and has shut the lions' mouths, that they have not hurt me. For as much as before him innocency was found in me, and also before thee, O king, have I done no hurt. Then was the king exceedingly glad for him, and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no manner of hurt was found upon him, because he believed in his God. And the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions had the mastery of them, and break all their bones in pieces, or ever they came at the bottom of the den. And again throughout the Bible, it's the same story, that the enemy of God, they try and try and try again to harm God's people, and they never succeed. They just cannot do it. Balaam tried to curse Israel, and God turned it to a blessing. Joseph's brethren, they sold him as a slave, and then Joseph was put into prison, and God turned it for a blessing. Esther was taken as a virgin into the king's harem, and God turned it around for a blessing. And Daniel, too, all his enemies plotted against him. They had it, who could escape? It was a perfect trap. Certainly Daniel would be destroyed, thrown in with hungry lions. No man could escape that, except they did not factor in the hand of God. And so it turns that because Daniel lives, all they themselves are killed. And that also is Purim, when God's enemies, Haman, and plotted against Mordecai and the Jews, and it's turned to where the enemies themselves are the ones that are killed. And so we can see this principle throughout the Bible. But it goes on in verse 24, and the king commanded, and they brought those men which had accused, I read that, I think. Verse 25, then King Darius wrote unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom men tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall be even unto the end. He delivereth and rescueth, and he worketh signs and wonders in heaven and in earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius, even in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And again, we see the great glory that that is brought to God for delivering Daniel, and that comes too at the end of this spiritual fiery trial, when God delivers all of his people, he will be greatly glorified. Okay, we have come to the end of our time tonight. I did a little bit more talking tonight than normal. So sorry about that. We didn't get in too many questions, but Lord willing, perhaps if you had a question, you can join us later this week, Thursday night and Friday night at 10 p.m., Lord willing. We'll also open up this room, and everyone's welcome to come back, and you can make a comment at that time or ask your question. But for now, I'm going to say good night, and may the Lord grant us his wisdom.